And just to reassure everybody, we have made sure that the fire in the background is approved by the fire marshal. Nobody can get on.
That's not Ventura County.
Also, well, perfect. There we go. All right. Can everybody see us still? Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to this fireside chat with HGST, a division of Western Digital Storage Solutions, and Eli
from IC.
And the goal before we release you into cocktail time and general merrymaking is to have a conversation, which does, by invitation, include all of you, in terms of we've spent a day talking about content security. We want to round this out and sort of close on a mellow note in terms of where does that connect with the actual storage that is used for holding all these assets. And especially in talking with Eli, HGST is a division of Western Digital that focuses primarily on object storage on premises. And I think the time for a conversation about security in on-premise storage is now. When we're talking about what we are offering from a media and entertainment perspective for yourselves and your customers, the petabyte scale of on-premise object, and I think in your previous session you were sort of alluding to some of the challenges of simply transporting media content at the 4K, 8K, or multi-thousands of assets scale into a public cloud calls for the equivalent on-premise, which is on-premise object storage. And when we're looking at what we are offering from a storage solution, we're also very focused on what layers of security do we have in storage solutions today when it comes to drive encryption, live encryption, and most importantly, access. And I think you were referring to that single source of truth in a previous conversation. On-premise object storage has that potential to be the single source of truth, the place where content is aggregated and moved into varying parts of the environment. Mm-hmm. And I would first of all love to hear some of your thoughts in terms of how do you define security when you're looking at storage on premises?
Well, the good thing about that is it's a problem that's kind of already been solved, right? Like there are policies that govern storage on premise. There are policies governing access to it, policies governing the roles that are able to mount or access any file that is on storage, that is on premise. And you're working within a model that you already know. So it's a known commodity, it's something that's repeatable, it's something that's auditable, you have total control of it, and you're able to satisfy any of the items that exist having to do with things like key rotation, key custody, a key segregation, where if you need a master key in order to go in and start looking at content or at assets that shouldn't be able to, you require multiple stakeholders from a given entity or enterprise to do so. But beyond that, one of the things you mentioned earlier was cloud providers and object storage and using on-premise storage as a single source of truth. And I think that there's a really unique and useful case to be made for that, especially in the world where we need to be cloud agnostic, right? Like, every studio, every production, every stakeholder in the industry is going to have a different cloud provider and a different secret sauce that exists in the cloud. Could be using AWS Core Services, you could be using GCP with Stackdriver and other tools to build up that environment that you need to scale in the cloud. But if you're working with third parties and you're working with entities other than the production in order to do it, well, how do you ensure that there's fidelity and how do you ensure that they're able to scale and use those services or access those services in a manner that makes sense? And on-premise object store is something that can be used to satisfy that requirement. And the beauty of it is you're able to follow whatever security model you set either in the cloud with the IAM rules and policies and on-premise.
So to follow up on that, when you're talking about access to storage, how do you distinguish between access to storage on premise and accessing that same information when you need to go external? Are you talking about still having walls of physical segregation, or are you talking about a security model that kind of mitigates that factor?
The security model that mitigates that factor.
Okay.
One where any logical controls that you put in place on-premise are going to be replicatable virtually and vice versa.
So that brings up that favorite topic of mine, which is you're advocating a model of privacy mm-hmm. versus obscurity.
Mm-hmm.
It's no longer the fact that the password is 12 letters long and has the CEO's daughter's name and puppy in it. It's the fact that this data is not accessible without going through the right protocols.
Correct, you're there. It also, and I know we're talking about security, but security is tied intrinsically to risk, right? And when we think about on-premise storage, well, one of the good things about it is it's a known commodity and you're able to access it assuming that your internal network is up and running. When working with cloud providers, if you need a highly available solution that you're going to be using over and over again, you have ingress, egress costs, but this isn't about cost. You also have the reliability and issues having to do with phoning out through a connection outside of your enterprise to a cloud provider. And earlier this year, we saw the massive distributed denial of service attack against Dyn, and we saw S3 go down for, I think it was about 6 hours one day, I want to say in March. But in an environment where business can't stop and downtime equals money, you can't really afford that. And in media and entertainment, with 24-hour productions that are running, where processes are being worked on all day, every day, in India, in Europe, in North America, and in APAC, you need to make sure that you have a solution that is going to be there if you're not able to provide, if you're not able to connect with your provider.
So you're saying let's take the scenario of geo-replicated mm-hmm. object storage versus having the same access in the cloud. What I'm hearing you say is that essentially, if I have the production assets stored in a cloud equivalent model, you can apply the same security policies but have far more on the 5 or 69s, far more reliability in a consistent access to that same data.
Yeah, and far more is relative, right? Like, there are service level agreements that are going to be out there, and there will be downtime if you have a service that you don't have in-house, and there may be downtime with in-house services too, but you have a greater semblance of control.
And where do you... Well, I think another very important aspect of this security conversation is simply version control.
Mm-hmm.
In that sense that What we're looking at from a customer side is customers want to be able to have all of the versions, but they want them to be in one place. When you're doing work with customers about the storage they have versus what they're bursting up,
mm-hmm.
what is your recommendation for a secure way of keeping a minimum amount of versions in the right place? What I'm trying to say is, we're looking at massive amounts of data at a petabyte scale,
mm-hmm.
as well as per production, per workflow.
Mm-hmm.
Those things don't work together if I'm saying I have a giant archive that is meant to be all of the assets of my customer, or in the case of a service provider, my customers, and I also have to build these bespoke, secure workflows. What is a storage option? What is a on-premise storage solution that is flexible to having the whole archive and the workflows in one place? And it's a big question, so maybe you want to break it down.
It's a very big question. Yeah. In the prior talk, I talked about understanding workflows, understanding what is going to be happening to your data as it is transformed, as it is updated, as you extend trust to it. Having an idea of who is able to access that data, chain of custody, and the ability to revoke access to a given piece of content at any given time is a very tricky and very difficult problem to solve.
Right.
It requires a lot of engineering. It requires insight into what these flows are, and it also requires in-depth knowledge of how the information is going to be transformed when it is in the hands of a custody, a third party, or when it's being transformed or used internally.
Mm-hmm. So, you're helping me make the point that I think is important for this conversation. Encryption isn't the answer.
No, encryption isn't going to solve that for you. It's workflows, access, versioning, archive, and being able to at any point in time pinpoint how, when, where, and who an asset was created by. You need to be able to do that. You also need to know what the golden source is for that asset, any copies that are created, and where those copies end up. And encryption is incredibly useful as a production tool and is a great part of a workflow and should be a part of any storage solution that you have to allow folks access to that given piece of content. But it's not the answer, and it's not going to handle that for you. There is a lot of work that needs to be done, it's intelligence. And encryption is not going to solve that.
How much does being able to identify unique assets help you to get closer to the solution?
I think it's hugely important. One, it gives you insight into what it takes to get from point A to point B. So business intelligence is incredibly important. Understanding how much time, what the cost is, and who is transforming a given piece of asset, a given asset is tough. Like, it's really hard to do. Mm-hmm. And if you're able to do that, you're able to gain this level of insight that you've never had in the past.
Right. And one of the efforts that my team is working on in terms of what are answers that are necessary for storage solutions in the media world today is focused on those unique assets, looking at things like the SMPTE ratified C4 checksum and unique identifier combination. But more important,
I was going to ask. So in the case of media and entertainment, and in these workflows, it's a lot of disparate systems that need to communicate with storage. These systems may not be set up to talk with an object store, but if they are, in the case that they aren't, what does the process look like to get that set up? Because that is overhead and cost that an enterprise or a customer or whoever wants this process to be completed have to go through. How do you walk folks through that? Like, what does the process look like in order to get there?
Well, I think what we're coming up against, and that was sort of part of my complaints, this is the big bulk of issues question earlier, is that no matter the size of your entity, if you're simply, and I use simply again in a relative term, doing post-production, or if you are the archivist for a major content owner, archive is more and more playing a role in storage that isn't that traditional, here's a room with some shelves and put some tapes in it. Archive now is much more about what you were saying, which is how do I get from an audit trail to knowing the existence of a specific asset? Mm-hmm. And the biggest challenge for that is that when you're talking about insular storage, when you're talking about SneakerNet, when you're talking about this traditional, here is my high-profile production SAN, here is where it goes into a vault, and here's where it goes over to production, as in content distribution, you're no longer going one path, and then you have that asset diversification where the same asset lives in different places under different names. And I think that is a security issue, is that that's the business need today. What I think, that's my belief, and that is what we're doing our best to help customers achieve, is to say, think of your archive not just as the place where the media comes to rest, but the place where media is identified as unique. And if we can achieve that, an object store is ideal for that, because objects by themselves are unique. You're no longer living in file folder arborescence. I think one of the scariest aspects of the industry as it stands today is how much relies on file folder arborists. How many productions, and you see that on a given day, is really dependent on the fact that people understand that the green color code in the finder is assigned for okay, and how easily that can break.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
And you can't make an industry change these habits overnight. but you can offer a solution that takes away some of the risk of only being able to identify assets in that way by saying yes, and then you put it over here where it's safe and where we have a different way of creating archives, where we have a different way of taking these artisanal categories and making them real categories, which then presented back to you in terms of doing audits or giving advisory to customers, says, here is something that's been categorized properly as that was that production asset in that arborescence, but it's no longer based on location, but on identity.
Yep, and that makes perfect sense.
You were asking me a question, I went on a longer answer, but I think really that identity for assets in file storage has to depend on more than just knowing where it came from.
Well, exactly, and it can't just be name-driven, and it can't be, well, Bob in Archive knows how to find asset A. Like, that's not the way a robust asset management system or file management system is going to work.
That's, well mm-hmm. and what you're pointing out, which is also the other very important part about storage today, is we're talking about asset management systems when in reality those are professional librarians.
Yes.
Asset management systems, the way that they're commercialized today, always have that notion of a filter of knowledge, the way that a professional librarian would have a filter of knowledge that is applied to a data set. But we can't afford that anymore. So when we're talking about the way that we're organizing storage from a data storage perspective, which technically should also apply to cloud, except that's just that giant pile where you throw things.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, and I actually want to open up another topic of discussion having to do with cloud and on-premise. So on-premise object store has its place. It is important. It can be used to satisfy some pretty specific use cases, and it can be used effectively. How do you go about talking through disaster recovery and business continuity planning? Is the cloud a part of that? Is that something that you're actually working into these flows? And if so, what guidance are you giving? Because I have some ideas.
Absolutely.
But I'm curious to hear how things are done, because you live and breathe this every day.
Right, and that's a great question in terms of today when you're talking about object storage. Object storage, by definition, has to be resilient. Mm-hmm. Whether it's Reece-Solomon or some other algorithm that is underneath it that simply protects your physical data storage just the way you expect it to be protected in the cloud. Exceptions happen. The easiest way to ensure the best level of redundancy is obviously to have a geodistributed system. Mm-hmm. So that means essentially you have two sites that are in production and one site that is DR. All of them share a single file system. All of them share a namespace. And all of them build parity so that the data travels freely from each of those sites and is accessible at any of those sites. Now, for quite a few entities, that's not something you can afford to build off the bat, so then you have to come up with a replication scheme that both replicates but maintains unique IDs. That's where you're saying you have some ideas. We'd love to hear about those.
Well, with that, rather than having a geo-distributed workload, if we're talking about business continuity, we're talking about disaster recovery, mm-hmm. having cloud-based connectors out to object storage where you're recreating the metadata tags and all the attributes of your storage with whoever your preferred provider is,
right.
kind of allows you to ingress content to that environment really at no cost to content owner, right? It's one of those things where it's on the egress cost, where you pull it out and you start paying through the nose. But if we're talking about it as disaster recovery, where it's something that you're not going to have to access all that often, and you don't need a geo-resilient or geo-redundant solution, maybe that's a way of saving your customers some cost, creating a system that is disaster recovery proof, building in intelligence and process that allows a smaller level customer who maybe doesn't have the resources of your behemoths and titans of media entertainment to have that that assurance and to have that solution set up. It also allows, if you start going down that path, to create full cloud native solutions
right?
Where you are able to replicate out to them. And I'm curious to know, with Object Store, is there a path towards cloud and Western Digital or HGST focusing on that? Like, I'm assuming that there have to be thoughts there, and I don't know if you can talk about it, but I'm just curious.
Well, I can't speak directly to future product development.
Mm-hmm.
However, what you're talking about is that's my logic. Mm-hmm. I'm saying if you have object native, as in S3 compatible on-premise storage, then whatever management layer you're implementing at that level is going to translate to a full-on migration.
Yep.
Whether you want to have simply the redundancy or the ability, as processes needed, to have data available in the cloud or on-premises, the data remains identical. And I think that's one of the biggest challenges that you would otherwise be facing if you're talking about transitioning from traditional file systems to object. You have to recreate the same metadata logic in a different place.
And that is a nightmarish process.
We want you to have sweet dreams after a fireside chat, no nightmares. And I think that's where we can really achieve that. With that, we've passed the almost
like
half an hour.
Yeah, I feel like we're supposed to open this up
please.
To the group. So we'll shut up now. What questions do you have?
Yes.
Just a side your reference to C4, that's simply standard 2114.
Thank you.
A little too nerdy there.
No, please.
So you were talking about a process for checking out assets.
Right.
Earlier in the talk. So first off, when you say asset, what do you mean?
That's a great question. What we're referring to when we're looking at storage paradigms, asset becomes anything from a molecular individual image file that could be part of an image sequence or part of an image asset for 3D texture to the entire collection of every transformer model or every starship from your science fiction franchise that has ever been stored, that is categorized as part of the same project. And it's a great question, because that becomes part of the challenge of, do you protect them the same way?
Yeah, and not all assets are created equal, and not all assets are of equal value depending on where in the life cycle you're accessing, right? Because in the production process, and we're talking about pre-release models of Transformers that the world has never seen before, well, that's obviously more valuable than a model of Optimus Prime from 2008 or whenever the first movie came out. And your ability to grant access to that model for derivative workflows or for your customers or your partners to be able to use it in advertising campaigns or whatever context they need changes based on where in the life cycle you are. So you're able to ramp up or ramp down protections and actually change the model of how you protect your assets based on where in the life cycle that asset is being accessed.
And what you're raising as a point is also another very specific challenge to the industry, which is storage from the ground up, the way that it exists today, is designed around privilege. And you were talking about privilege earlier, which means if I have privilege, I have access to a certain part of my data tree with an asset or assets. Storage, the way it exists today, has no native concept of check-in, check-out. And when we're talking about media entertainment, whether we're talking archive or production, essentially we have to have either an audit trail that can be leveraged after the fact to see whether check-in, check-out transactions happened, or preferably we want to have a mechanism that does that. We can't build it natively into storage. And at the same time, we can't force end users to rely on an asset manager. The biggest opportunity we have here today is to say, for example, from a centralized archive, to say data should not exist outside of a centralized and controlled archive past a certain perennity, past a certain time period. That's one of the control mechanisms that can be implemented in a healthy way, without having to break things.
Right. So, I actually used to be an artist, and
post-production work, so I wanted to make sure that my asset was the same as your asset, which it is.
That's right.
So, you know, when I would show up for work one day, I wouldn't know what I was working on, right? Another artist might call out sick. I'd have to take over their shots. And all of a sudden now, you know, there's ACLs that would have to be applied to me. So when you're talking about your process that, you know, at an individual asset level, to me as that artistic mindset, I'm thinking that's a delay. You know, I now have a deadline. So when you were talking about that process, what were you...
You're bringing up this great point in terms of if I'm looking at traditional file systems, somewhere in a part of the organization that has not that much to do with what you're talking about, the stuff that's on your desktop, somebody has to create that space and that authority and that access. When we're having a conversation around what can object storage help do in that context, the access to an object store is much more defined from a point of view, which is your own point of view. So rather than having to define, to depend on a top-down authority that creates users that then have certain privileges with the object store, because your way, if you build it though, and I sort of see you not disagreeing with me, which it has to be architected that way, but that's the opportunity. If you build it in a way where your point of entry means you're part of a project which then has those assets assigned to it, also gives you that access. That's the way it should be, and that's part of what we can achieve with object storage today, because you're no longer stuck in Windows Active Directory, ACL authentication, etc., which is an IT terminology that doesn't help you in a project perspective. If you're looking at the marketplace today, there's a number of vendors that have built specialty products exclusively for production environments because the traditional IT authority model doesn't work. Our effort is to make that more native and, for example, through the use of these unique identifiers, give you authority to be using any part of a project that is associated with those unique identifiers. So to let it be far more production-centric rather than IT-centric.
Yeah, that actually the C4 stuff came out of that, understanding what assets are what and what you're working on and making sure you had the same thing or we're talking even about the same thing. That was kind of the whole rudimentary level of what they were attempting to do with UTC when they built this.
That's right. It's as an industry, it's our job to build this to make your work far more feasible rather than being reactive or specific to, for this problem where we feel there's a danger we have to respond. It should be something where you can say, I prescribe this and it applies immediately.
Exactly. And that is a solution that is going to hold across pretty much the entire industry. Because
that's right.
The model is established. You understand
that's right.
What the requirements are. If you're able to build that resiliency into the actual object store layer, well then, great. You have a value add right there.
That's our goal. All right. Any more questions?
Aren't you just starting?
No.
I want to hear all that over
again. Well, we were talking about redundancy, so.
Let's take it from the top.
I have one question. So it seems to me the architecture and cost of physical on-site storage versus cloud, they work in different dimensions, right? They've got different pluses, minuses, and so on. Has anybody done any studies on the TCO over a period of 5 to 10 years of, you know, starting out with, say, a petabyte and growing that 20% year on year versus, looking at on-premise versus cloud? Has any of that kind of work been done? Because
absolutely. So you'll find that there's some Gartner studies which I think are publicly accessible, and I know internally we've done specific research into what is the TCO at a petabyte scale for the kind of storage solutions that we're putting in place. What it comes back to, and that's to your point earlier, anytime that you're storing an asset, and you're defining a lifetime, as in you're saying, this is something we need to keep for 2 years, this is something we need to keep for 5 years, this is something we need to keep for 10 years, or if we're talking about Vault and if we're talking about Crown Jewels, they're going to be here forever. We're talking about the balance of just carting it off to Iron Mountain, you know, and storing it in a salt mine on a tape, never to be seen again, or the cloud equivalent of that, where it is simply, we have to keep this with no intention of using it again.
Yeah, I'm not really thinking about that. I'm thinking about active data.
Exactly. Yeah. And so the moment you're talking about active data sets, you're also talking about what you were saying, which is, I have to calculate my business risk of having an active data set that is only available through a third party versus I have an active data set that is available within my premises through my data infrastructure.
Sure.
So essentially...
That applies to everything, but as with many other business services, everything's going to get cloud deployed because of the advantages of doing that, right?
Correct.
So
why
would those advantages not apply to storage?
I think the TCO calculation that you're making, and we're having conversations about that, and there are tools that we use internally, and there are tools that third-party vendors are now offering, that give you your answer of what is my hybrid solution. And I think it comes back to that. It's I would be remiss to say you have to put everything on-premise on our storage, and that's going to give you exactly the TCO you want. I can do a calculation in terms of that is going to have XYZ cost, which based on my estimate of the equivalent cloud ingress egress cost, if you're saying it's active and I'm using it, is going to cost you less. But
yeah.
I'm not sure.
Yeah, you're right about that. And the thing about cloud is if you're going to burst out and start using processes for compute heavy jobs or loads, you're able to connect from your on-premise to your cloud provider. You don't have to pay those ingress or egress costs. You're able to perform your operations in that environment that you spin up. Destroy that environment when you're done, so there's no copy of that content outside of the four walls of your infrastructure, while at the same time not having ingress, egress costs and knowing exactly what the TCO is. And when it comes to TCO, it's incredibly tricky with cloud because you have to know what the usage is going to be and how often you're going to be writing in and out. And in some cases, it's probably going to be cheaper than on-premise. In other cases, it's probably not. And really understanding what that flow is going to be over time is going to be how you're going to make the determination and also how you're geared up as an enterprise to either manage the infrastructure or manage those services, because it is going to require overhead management. And you,
sure, I mean, either way you go. Right?
Yep.
And that's really the kind of case studies more interesting is in looking at different usage models of that active data.
Yep.
Right?
Correct.
So very infrequent usage. Mm-hmm. So the Gartner reports you're talking about, do they provide that level of analysis, or are they just more kind of...
They're doing side-by-side comparisons more because it's a variance that can only be looked upon in terms of what your business is. However, it's you know, 50% of any investment into R&D or other explorations is the part that you can't see. You have to have a willingness to go down a certain path before you can see what the ROI is. How do you mitigate that? I think that what it comes back to is, on the one hand side, we're looking at ownership models. So if you're talking about building a hybrid cloud with some on-prem portions to it, with a vendor like ourselves, we'll have a conversation around this is what we think your needs are. These are the models where you can acquire it either, you know, by the drop, so you can have a usage model, or you can simply put a footprint that you're planning to grow. So that's one side of it where you're simply looking at what it is you're putting in place on a footprint perspective. The other part of it is, in order to know what it is you're doing, you have to have a precedent. So back to audit. Back to how do you measure not just the footprint that you have in storage, but also the success of your storage strategy.
Yeah. And another important thing to note with TCO, these are costs as presented today. Once you hitch your horse to the cloud wagon and that's where everything lives, switching costs tend to become high when you start making use of core services. And having some backup plan or some way to bring that back and do away with those costs in the future is really important. So even if you're running that hybrid model, or you want to go full cloud native, knowing that you're not going to be stuck in with a given provider and with a given technology over time, it's probably useful, at least from a risk mitigation and just best business practice perspective.
So some of the other papers that might be interesting for you to look at are the IOA interconnects. They have a public page that talks about interconnect-oriented architectures. So it shows you how to kind of centralize that storage and then create a multi-cloud or a hybrid strategy where you can move to these different places and you're centralizing. Techniques like you said, where you're sending off or you're mounting AWS, basically, to run anything from analytics to transcode to anything like that you might need, and then just destroying what you sent and just taking back the answers to minimize your egress fees if you have them. But and then things like direct connect to all these primary ones.
So that paper is available.
Yeah, they have a whole site on papers. Talking about different aspects of that. So if you go to IOA Equinix, I mean, you can use it with other providers too, but they have an exchange.
And what you were saying earlier about your collaborator named Bob, you want to know within different departments what is it you're actually storing in terms of, am I taking production data that is only valuable in the context of that production that if I just store it as an archive, can't be recovered in that way because it is linked to the organizing principles that Bob is using, or am I storing finalized masters as their DCP in a completely compact format that is recoverable? On the one hand side, I need to keep a secure instance of that data for a certain amount of time because obviously time has been spent and work has been invested into creating that content. I'm not going to rely on storage on-premise to be available for that. However, that may be much more temporary. That may be something where specifically on-premise storage, on-premise object archive is exactly what I want to do as I ponder what my long-term strategy with those assets is. I don't want to be able to, I don't want to immediately delete them, but I don't want to also, like you were saying, invest in sending those into a cloud space if I may have more transactions planned for those assets in the near-term future.
Yeah, and so as we move towards this, and I'm not sure which side you're on, whether it's content ownership or operating on content that the content owner is giving you permission to do.
The latter.
So on the latter side, your content owner is going to have multiple different, you're going to be dealing with multiple different content owners, with multiple different providers, and you're going to have to find a way to play nice with each of them.
Sure, no, I totally understand. I was asking more of a theoretical thing to understand how these costs work out.
Mm-hmm. Right.
If you could ignore the data transfer costs, some of those things, and just look at how the costs bear out in just day-to-day operation, right? So, but yeah, I mean, I totally get it with some of the topics you were talking about in the previous talk, the ingress and egress costs start mounting up, so.
Yeah.
Well, I think, I mean, we're having a conversation here about security, and the conversation about security as much as the conversation about storage strategy, they both come back to the same thing. Include a landing space in that strategy so that you both have the ability to plan security before you act on the storage, but you also have the freedom to implement it at that point where you have to make that decision if you didn't have the time, the liberty, or whatever else it is to do it beforehand. That's what we're talking about, and I think that's where your total cost of ownership and ROI are measured in terms of, did I have the freedom to make a choice when I wanted to? That's where you'll see how it works out and how you actually get your cost back. All right. Thank you very much.
Thanks, everyone. Thank you.